So. Ooh, I sound really loud now.
No, today is good.
Yeah. Everybody looks good. The levels are nicely balanced. I'm not hearing too much breathing. I got a good feeling about this.
It keeps itching.
Note to self, Dan, remember to breathe because you can't hear it.
Oh, I thought you were laughing at my sigh. Because
That's what I was laughing at.
It keeps itching my ear, and I don't know why. Maybe I have this on.
That's what she said? It's weird.
Weird.
That's just weird. So we seem to be in remarkably jolly spirits, considering that we all just stuffed our faces.
Yeah, I'm much happier now that I have pie, because earlier today I was in a grumpy mood.
I got to fake it. It's all fake enthusiasm.
So we better
right
get
now.
Down to business, because your faux adrenaline might run out. Is that what you're telling me?
No, he's going to fall asleep because he's in a food coma.
Okay. It's the gluten, man. I don't want to start sounding like Dan Benjamin, but...
No, I totally agree. It's the gluten. I don't think I should cut gluten completely out of my diet, but I do notice that I get sleepy if I eat like if a you
wanna
whole eat, bowl of pasta or something.
Yeah, but if you want to have pizza at 2 a.m., that's fine. I mean, you're going to sleep anyway. You might have restless dreams. But no, like that 2:30 feeling, I swear to God, they're just gluten. People go eat fast food and they shove a bunch of hamburger buns in their mouth. And
sugar and stuff, too.
Yeah, that's not helping.
What did we decide to talk about today?
The Voice!
The show with CeeLo and the Maroon 5
Voice!
Guy?
The Voice!
You're peeking.
I know.
That is if you... So now, I know I'm encouraging everyone to sit
voice.
Close. There you go. That was perfect. You wrote it right at
100%. Can I have that be my error message beat?
Yeah. Should we do a few more takes?
The Voice! I can't stop laughing.
Hello, you're listening to episode 24 of The Flyover Effect, a podcast about startups, design, and all things internet. I'm Scott Rocketship, your producer and frequent co-host. Also in this episode, you'll be hearing from Amanda Morrow and Dan Shipton. We all work at BitMethod. You can learn more about our company at www.bitmethod.com. In case you hadn't gathered from Amanda's songful intro, this episode is all about voice, product voice, and putting a little humanity into the way you communicate, both online and off. Enjoy the show.
Your product, your site, everything should be like a person. And they should be consistent, and they shouldn't say anything that's weird, that's out of place, that they have a personality. And it's one of those things that kind of reaches into UX, it reaches into content strategy, it reaches into branding. And very few people do it very, very well. So one example that I was explaining to Dan a couple times is, you know, like, I'm a vegan. I don't eat meat. I don't eat dairy, eggs. If I turn to Dan one day...
Or unicorn farts,
because those are not vegan. No, I don't. Anyway.
They wouldn't be.
Inside jokes.
So the idea is that if I'm sitting there, I'm like, man, Dan, I'm really hungry. Let's go grab a steak for lunch. That is weird, probably, and he'd either think I'm joking or that something's wrong with me, because that's not something I would say normally.
It's inconsistent.
Yes. So this happens all the time on people's websites. I'm trying to think of a good industry. I keep going back to the banking industry, because a lot of times their marketing is very friendly, warm, you know, encouraging. And then you go into the actual product, like their online banking systems or something, and it's very bank speak. And it's like, oh, wait, where did all that friendliness go? You know, or what does all this stuff mean? So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
And it's a poor mirror of the real world. Because in the real world, if you go to a bank, like in real life, like you go to a bank, you're talking to a banker, someone who's kind of upselling you on product. But maybe then they have to bring in, you know, someone more formal, or say you're closing on a house and like the lawyers show up, or someone like that's a little more serious. The transition is more natural because it's actually coming from a different person.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a little context to it. And maybe somebody even has a chance to tell you, okay, Bill's coming in. You know, he's going to seem a little intense, but I promise he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
And you don't ever get that warm up online. It's just all of a sudden you're talking to Bill on this web form, and no one told you that Bill was coming in, and the Bill's a little serious.
Yeah.
And it's very incongruous with any of the friendly little mascots and or, you know, stock photography of these happy families and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just something to really consider. And I don't even know if a lot of people really realize it about their products, because you, especially when you, everything is very departmentalized, like you have marketing taking care of one section, you have your development team taking care of, you know, other forms of copy, you know, you have a blog versus your homepage, like all that stuff should be fairly consistent. And if it's not, you need to make it very clear that, okay, this is the legal speak, maybe even make fun of it a little bit, but just say, you know, hey, we got to be serious for a second. I think a good example of this is like Woot. Like Woot is very consistent throughout everything. Like they're goofy. Everything's very well written, well thought out. But it's consistent all the way through. Even when I go to like buy something or sign in, like it's kind of quirky and like witty with everything they do.
It's like the 404 page, right? Like that comes up as a detail a lot. And, yeah. And those get shared around. That's kind of its own little viral meme now. But the idea is if you have this fun, consistent voice and then all of a sudden you have to tell someone this error has occurred, the content they're not looking for, the content they're looking for isn't there, why suddenly be all serious and techie in that instance? Yeah. And that was a detail that a lot of people missed for a long time. It's one particular detail that's catching on. People are going, oh, geez, maybe we should do something fun with this. It's almost happening backwards. Like people realize, oh, gee, if we do a fun, quirky 404 page, people will catch on and maybe they'll share it. Maybe they'll talk about us. But, you know, if you have a very serious site and then a goofy 404 page, that's bad voice, too.
Well, and even just, you know, speaking to people like they're people, like error pages and error messages are a perfect example of this. Like no one knows what error 404 means. Like the normal person, the layman's guy, that's an inside joke as well. Anyway, they don't know what that means. The image that's been shared around from, what is it, the new version of Windows, the one where it says...
The blue screen with this frowning face. Yeah,
you know, something's wrong with your computer, just restart. Like, holy cow, why did it take so long to do that? Like.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no...
Speaking to people like they're people? Go figure.
There was no technological advancement that made it possible for that to suddenly sound like a human being
talking
to you.
It's just like noticing those details. Like, hey, okay, maybe people are restarting their computer a lot or they keep running into this error message. Let's make it as clear as possible what's going on and make it so it's consistent with all the rest of our software.
At the same time, you know, back in the day, I don't know, that nerd speak kind of was the voice of XP. At the same time, you know, like Windows 7 is all very friendly, like, you know, hello, how are you? And so that page or, you know, when something catastrophic happens, that seems very natural for it to come up and say, you know, I'm really sorry. Here's a frowny face. Whatnot. Please restart your computer. But I think they were sticking to their voice back in the day as well.
Yeah, and maybe there was just a little too much bravado when it was first built out. Like, well, the only person who's even going to see this message is, you know, a system administrator or somebody very techie. Like, because it's a very stable system. I mean, it's not going to crash on the users, so why even worry about the message? But at the same time, like, when you're doing, like, tech people speak English, too. And if something's, you know, if something's laid out Mad Lib style or the documentation is in very human, buzzwordy free language, that helps, especially considering how much of our industry is self-taught.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because if you didn't have to pass a vocabulary test to get into the discipline that you're in, you might know 93% of what you need to know, but there's just a little bit that's missing. And if someone doesn't take the time to explain that, it's going to be very frustrating.
Well, I mean, a perfect example of this is newspapers. They, in journalism school, they always tell you, you know, write to the lowest common denominator, but not like, don't dumb it down, but, you know, really be careful about using large words and stuff like that, because you can still speak and inform people in a way that everyone understands it. But, you know, you want to make sure that you're not going over somebody's head. It's a good approach to take with when you're writing. The thing back to like the Windows stuff is the problem too, is we have a lot of this like legacy stuff where it's, it's been always done like that. That's why I think iOS is so interesting, because it was such a new approach to everything that they could start from scratch. That's why I strongly, strongly believe any new product coming out, there's no excuse to not be picking up on those things right away. You have a fresh start, talk to people like they're people, and go with it.
So how do these things come together? Where does voice come from? Where do you look for, like, where do you look to when you're trying to follow a voice of a product or
the user?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to know who you're talking to. And I mean, a lot of it is the personality of who's building it as well. You know, like we're pretty quirky and, you know, kind of goofy with a lot of things we say. But you also need to know who you're talking to and who you want to connect with, because that's like your chance to actually make your product seem human. And you're trying to connect with other humans, you know. So, like, I can't remember where I listened to this, but there was a story about researching how to make the Furby and how to get people to connect with it. They tried to do like a couple things to make it very human. So, you know, it blinks its eyes and stuff. And then they were trying to figure out what sounds it was going to make. And they tested a couple different things. And I'm really hoping this is the Furby. I think that's what the toy was. But they tested a couple things with kids and how it would react if it was like scared. And one of them was if you held it upside down, it would start squealing. And like kids instantly like flipped it back over because they're like, oh God. And they like reacted to it like it was an actual thing. And I think they tried the same thing with a puppy and then maybe something else that wasn't like, that was like a robot type device. I'm sorry. I can't really remember the whole story, but basically the whole idea was like, why did the kids act so quickly when that Furby started squealing? You know, and it was the whole idea that it was connecting with something in them that is like, oh God, it's angry or it's upset. I need to flip it back over. I think they did a couple time trials on it and stuff. And it was really quick when the Furby, like, you know, they were just like, I can't handle this. And so that's what I'm kind of getting at, is you have to connect to, you know, figure out who you're connecting to and connect to them.
But as a company, who holds that, right? If you take the new Find My Friends app on iOS, it doesn't look like anything Apple does, except for maybe the calendar a little bit. It looks like somebody said, oh, look, somebody got away with it in calendar. I'm going to just take it to the extreme here. Mm-hmm. And you know, if it was coming from a different company, you would say that's totally user-friendly, speaking to me, things like that. But for me, I don't think it follows the voice at all. How do you rectify those?
Well, I don't know. Who is their audience? Like, there's a lot of boxes that the Friends and Family app doesn't check in the user experience kind of evaluations that we would do for stuff. At the same time, it looks like a lot of other kind of almost lowbrow consumer software. And I think that's kind of the idea, right? Like, it's for mom and dad and the kids. And you know, we've got all these tech people, you know, kind of piling on top of this app. I think it looks like crap. I think it looks like crap. I think the messaging is crap. That I forgot thing on the login that you shared the twit pic of, like, they're playing jokes with the I brand, which doesn't really, like, I'm guessing that's probably explicitly written somewhere that they're not supposed to do that. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. Maybe it does work for their audience. Like, you don't have that audience first. Like, what Amanda's explaining, I think, is absolutely true. Like, you have to write something, craft that voice for your customer, but you don't have them at the outset, you know? And so, like, and that's where you see a lot of marketing fails or just stuff that comes off really cheesy. Like, I'm imagining the 90s when everything was extreme, you know, and if you wanted kids to buy something, it just had to be these screaming guys with spiky hair and neon, like, hey kids, come check out the new Extreme Doritos. They're super extreme and your parents are going to hate it. And, you know, that stuff didn't really resonate with me when I was younger, but it's because they didn't have, frankly, the marketing wasn't as sophisticated yet. Like, it wasn't as insidious. They weren't as connected to the market as well.
The kids saw right through it. I mean, we all saw through it. Like, there's a big difference between, like, the Ninja Turtles and then, like, what was it, Biker Mice from Mars or whatever, you know? Like,
and Street Sharks.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, I totally see what they're doing here, but it doesn't mean I'm going to like it just because it's a knockoff of it. Like, there still has to be that finesse. There still needs to be that originality to what you're saying that people are going to connect with.
Okay, so understanding the customer, like, I'm on board with that. I think that's absolutely the work that needs to be done. But starting from scratch, like, we just build a new... Bitmeth's building a new product now. We don't have any customers yet, right? Like, we know who we're building it for. We don't actually have any customers yet. Like, no one's paying us money to use this product. So everyone that we're crafting this voice around, we have a website out there now. It's all based on imaginary stuff, like whom we want our customers to be. And crafting that voice, you know, I think a lot of content strategy comes into it. And tech people are calling it content strategy now. Marketers a long time ago would have just called it demographics. You know, there's lots of different, there's lots of overlapping language in how this stuff comes together. But I know for me, working on it, pretty much just stuck with our field guide entry, imagining brands as people. You know, if your brand was a person, who would they be? I have it written out somewhere that our product, that Change, is the kind of younger independent business owner. You know, he comes from a professional background. He's got wingtips, but he's still wearing jeans and the cafe t-shirt, and, you know, spends all their time working on the product. So I've got a pretty clear picture in my head of who the customer is, and everything I'm writing, at least, I'm trying to make sound like something that person would respond to. And it's just, it just involves a bit of imagination to a certain extent.
And basically just talking to them like they're standing there, you know, so we're reading things out loud and saying, oh, wait, that sounds almost a little too techy. Or, you know, maybe if I was sitting in a coffee shop with this person, like, I wouldn't say that out loud. So why would I write it on the screen?
It's a practiced skill, like, especially for language. Like, I've gotten really good at a very theatrical sub-vocalization. Like, I don't have to actually say everything out loud. And I probably should, but you don't have time to go, I don't have time to go off into a corner and read absolutely every single word out loud back to myself 20 times. But, you know, being patient and slow and theatrical through sub-vocalization, just when you're reading it to yourself and kind of thinking, you know, how would I do this if I was reading it for the first time? And just getting it in front of a lot of people. Our COO, Igor, you know, English is not his first language. He speaks English very well, but it's not his first language. So he reads differently than I read. And he catches a lot of, like, double words and typo type stuff. But he also just catches some of my odd phrasings. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's often, to make things punchier, to just give it a little more impact, or just to tighten something up, I'll leave whole kind of phrases implied. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you just kind of shorten stuff up. And so I'll leave a whole phrase implied, and he just, he won't catch the implication. And so the thing just does not make sense to him. I'm holding on to an idea in my head that he didn't catch. And so that's the kind of editing that happens. But just getting in front of a lot of people helps. I feel like a lot of error messages and stuff just go unread by any more than even one person, which seems scary to me. That's definitely not our process. Like, we have a lot of eyes looking at everything, even down to what's on a button and the error messages and everything.
Well, and technically you shouldn't view them as error messages. It's like, okay, wait, where can we direct them? And that's another thing, is like, if I'm at a coffee shop and I'm ordering a mocha or something, the cashier doesn't all of a sudden go, error 3721, you know, like, you have to really think of it.
Insufficient,
like,
mocha.
Yeah. Like, you know, you have left out three details of your order, you know, like, things like that. You have to really look at, as if this was an actual person sitting in front of you, what would they say? How would they react? And how can you help them from there?
When we did the Design Plus Tech meeting about user experience, that was kind of my little bit on just being polite. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's what comes into play there. Like, I've been at restaurants and ordered something where the cashier or server will say, oh, we're out of that. and then they just look at you like it's your fault. Like, hey, dummy, you should have known we're out of that. Well, that's not very polite.
Yeah.
What would be polite is, oh, I'm so sorry, we just ran out. I don't care if they ran out 3 days ago. Just say we just ran out.
Yeah.
Because it makes me feel better. And then offer a solution, such as, you might like this.
Yeah.
Or how about I get X for you? Or tell you what, dessert's on us, you know. So, you know, we just ran out of the special, but dessert's on us. Is there something else you
that
want?
That totally happened recently when we were in Denver. We were ordering breakfast and they ran out of, like, biscuits or something. And so they're like, oh, we're out of this, but it's, you can order this dish, but it's exactly the same, just with, you know, a different option on it. And then she actually comped our drinks because she's like, I feel bad about that. You guys are kind of in a hurry. Here you go. And I was like, wow. And so I walked out of there, like, being like, man, I'll eat there 10 more times if I'm ever back in town, you know? So
when you talk about voice or branding, even in the startup world, like, some of the companies that come up as frequent examples are Woot, which you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
MailChimp,
huge.
Groupon, some of those, Apple even comes up. Here's the thing, like, I think people don't spend much time on voice because they think it has to be this over the top, like, through and through, thoroughly executed campaign that's built around, like, a really defined personality. And that's excellent if you can do it. I think maybe more what we're talking about here a little bit is just the base level A voice, like, putting humanity into your product, like, giving it some sort of voice. Because, like, when I met the bank, I don't expect everyone to be cracking jokes constantly or, you know, telling me a fantastic story. I run into personalities everywhere. I don't mind when they do, but I do expect them to treat me like a human being and just use English and not defend things based on, you know, certain clause numbers or something, like just explaining it in English.
Yeah, I mean, there's like so many examples where, oh gosh, we should almost make like a series of videos for this. Like, if I walk into, let's say it's like a company that makes some sort of product, like we make speakers or something. You don't walk in and they're like, hi, welcome to blah, blah, blah speaker company. We are the world's leading, you know, manufacturers of these speakers. And, you know, like, it's just, again, like, you wouldn't say that in real life. So why do you say, like, why do you do all the hyperbole on your website? And why do you just make it so generic? Like, it doesn't, no one believes that you're the leading, you know, speaker company. They don't care, you know?
And even if you are, they either know that and that's why they came, or you can show and not tell.
Yeah.
Like, if you've won a bunch of awards, then put a bunch of awards on a shelf.
Yeah.
You don't tell everyone about all of your awards. You just put them on the shelf.
Yeah.
And you let people look at them.
I think everyone could benefit from just going through and being like reading their stuff out loud and then just kind of looking at it. And like, if I was just talking to someone at dinner or, you know, going to lunch with someone, how would I explain this? And I guarantee your site not only will be more friendly, but it'll also probably cut down on a lot of your like ridiculous copy that you don't need. You know, like everything would be cut down a couple paragraphs.
How does voice come into play for you when you are just doing something visual? Like, you know, a lot of times, you know, you and I kind of share copywriting duties, really. Mm-hmm. Like for bigger stuff, like for outlining and doing the skeletons of things and like full page copy, that's generally me. But a lot of the stuff, that the interactive stuff, comes from both of us, and you'll refine it and I'll refine it. But when it's word free, when it's just like the impact on, you know, a landing page or something, how is that playing into what you do, making it feel human?
Well, and that's why I think designers could, you know, really contribute to this as well, because they're already picturing this sort of personality throughout the product. You know, so for instance, with Change, you know, we had this personality, this friendly young professional, you know, that factored into all my decisions, from the photography to the colors we chose to the fonts we choose. And then just the way we lay out the type, where it's very bold, right to the point headlines with a little descriptions underneath. You know, we don't have novels on that website. Like, it's very to the point. but I mean, that's why I say this voice makes a huge difference for branding, for content strategy, for user experience. Development is another one. You know, like, if Neil was just kind of, you know, not really paying attention to error messages and not letting us know, hey guys, this error's popping up, you know, right now it says something that's not very helpful to the user, like, he's really good about letting us know, like, hey, what else should we put here, you know?
Or even in the animations that the developer chooses, and some of those little details that are hard to map out in advance, of just making sure that visually people understand where they're going, where they came from, if they're in a new workflow, if they're going somewhere else. And that's all mappable back to real world stuff. You're not going to suddenly find yourself in a different room at the bank.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to blink. You know, when you finish signing a form, you're not going to suddenly be in a different room with different papers to fill out sitting in front of you. That doesn't happen in the real world, so it shouldn't happen in software. And that's the kind of stuff that poorly planned projects and interactions end up with. And that's... it's rude, you know. It's rude, it's disconcerting, it's lazy, and it definitely makes it so that developing that voice, that positive human tone, like, you're never going to get to a MailChimp level voice of fun and interaction if just the core product confuses people and leaves them with no idea where they are. Because at that point, it doesn't matter how friendly you are, if people are just lost.
Yeah, another thing too on the MailChimp front is, I think a lot of people try too hard to be quirky. When I say voice, I don't necessarily mean you have to be witty and you have to be funny and things like that. Like, people can see right through it. It's just like the extreme thing. Like, people know when you're like trying too hard. It's just talking to people like they expected to be talked to. For instance, I use Vanguard, which is, you know, an investment site. their stuff is very professional.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's, I had great customer service on there when I called to, you know, transfer something over. And like, it's exactly what I would expect from a site like that. They could probably still improve a little bit. Some stuff's a little hard to find, but the actual wording of everything is very friendly, very professional. It's not, you know, it makes me feel like I'm trusting them with my money.
So some of the don't be rude stuff too, it just comes down to like the work you're going to do in advance for the user, like work you're going to do before anyone's even asked, you know, and some of that is like documentation.
Yeah.
Just putting things into intelligent categories, tagging things intelligently, make it, even just in a blog post, simply going through and identifying everything that you think isn't necessarily universal knowledge, taking another 20 seconds to find a good article and linking to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That doesn't, you're not even adding words. There's nothing witty, nothing clever, anything there. But I think that's part of a voice of a product, is that like that saying, I'm going to help you, or here's this thing you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. And people miss that stuff. It's very easy to just rip by. And I miss it a lot too. You know, I go back through old posts and it's like, why are there no links in here? You know, I was probably just in a hurry that day. I was being lazy. I wasn't being the most helpful customer servicey type person I could.
Mm-hmm.
BitMethod does a lot of client projects, and even as we start off on our new thing, we're still going to be doing client work. And some of what comes along with that is working in someone else's voice, or adapting someone else's voice, or trying to figure out what somebody else's voice is if it's not immediately apparent. And I think where we've done well, where I hope we've done well, and that I hope people see, is focusing on innovating rather than inventing. You know, we're not, when we have an opportunity to do mobile for an existing voice brand product, we're not saying, okay, it's mobile, what should the mobile voice be? What should the mobile style be? You know, it's like, well, theirs is green, so we're going to make it black, and we're going to make it a little edgier and different. It's more, okay, what could be, what could stay the same? What's good? You know, what's best left behind? We're generally working with more constraints than people have on the web, just as far as even just character count. You know, you can make a title of a web page pretty darn long. You can make your about intro text pretty darn long. We don't have a lot of space to work with. We certainly don't want things going over multiple pages. So there's a lot of constraints that we're working with. But I think that idea of being, and even just in our general style of focusing on iteration, that innovating on the voice, how do we make it just a little bit better, a little bit more compact, efficient, whatever? That's what I am generally trying to bring to the table when we work on client stuff.
Yeah, I think the context is really important too, because, I mean, like you said, there's not necessarily a mobile voice, but it's like, how would this voice fit into mobile? Or, you know, how can we make it as consistent as possible across the board, you know? So if it says submit on the website, then we're probably going to use submit in the mobile version as well. But like you said, if there's 300 characters talking about, you know, what this product is, you know, maybe we have to approach that slightly differently. And sometimes it's even just cutting it down. You can still use those same words and that same voice, but maybe just not as verbose, you know?
And that's a tough skill for some people.
It is,
like to go, like, if you're used to, I don't know, only talking with your friends and family, and they get you, and you can just ramble. And now you are, I don't know, you're at a city council meeting, and they give you 90 seconds, and then the timer goes off. Or even at some of the events we do, where I tell folks, all right, you get 5 minutes to talk about this, and I'm cutting you off. That's very difficult. It's a very difficult skill. And I think it's something that, It's just a muscle you have to exercise.
Yeah. I think another thing that we haven't really talked about too much is just the idea of working with a large team and trying to bring all those, you know, basically have 20 people speak the same voice, which is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I think really helps with this, and, you know, you usually have this in other departments, you have someone who's always overlooking design, someone's always overlooking copy, someone's always overlooking development, etc. I think kind of picking the one person that, you know, really can catch that stuff. Like you said, Igor is really great about catching weird things. Dan's really good about catching things that might not sound too much like BitMethod. Scott, we both write stuff, and sometimes I think we kind of get in a bubble, you know, and it's like, Oh, wait. Yeah. Okay. Maybe we shouldn't do that. So I think always having someone look over it and say, hey, does this work? I mean, that's why people like Steve Jobs. He really was the voice of Apple and, you know, picked out those things.
Yeah. And it comes back a little bit to that outside perspective, because at the end of the day, however much work I put into developing a voice for a product, however much I'm copying and pasting from previous texts that I've written, which I try and do a lot, it's still me. Like, I'm still the person writing it.
Yeah,
and it's,
exactly.
I'm, maybe when I hit level 60 on this stuff, when I, you know, a few years from now, maybe it'll be a little easier to extract myself from that process. But at the end of the day, it's still kind of me.
Yeah.
You know? And it's good and it's bad. I communicate in a certain way, and that has its merits, but it also makes some things trickier.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, getting other people to look at it is very important.
I think always referencing, you know, things that already exist too is helpful. I don't think you should always copy things word for word, but I think whenever I design something, I'm not going to start, you know, incorporating new colors. Same thing with your voice. Like, you shouldn't, you should kind of see where things are at currently. Flyers you've put out, the website, how you talk on Twitter, even things like that, and kind of start using that. And then not so much change things instantly, but kind of evolve more into the voice that you want.
Innovating, not inventing.
Yeah, exactly.
Every time, I don't have to log into the BitMethod Twitter account much because I have it connected to my tweet deck, right? But every time I have to on the web for whatever reason, just about every time I go in there and tweak the bio.
Yeah.
I tweak the bio. That's the important thing. I don't delete it. I don't say, you know what? I'm going to say this about us this week.
Yeah.
It's that I find one little word to cut. You know, or maybe I just swap the language a little bit. Sometimes you'll have been looking at something for a year and it becomes patently obvious that a phrase is just completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
Or that the thing you want to communicate is at the end of the sentence and not the beginning. You know, those little innovations. But that's the kind of stuff where maybe other folks don't even notice. And that's what's good. It's like the voice stays consistent. It just gets better.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that every year I'm on this earth, I communicate a little more succinctly and a little more effectively. And I think that's what you can do with your product, too.
Exactly.
The voice.
Every time I look over, Dan's just like...
The voice.
I was going to say something about boiling it down and being simple, but whatever.
Really there.
Yeah.
Your team knows how to talk for you.
I know.